Hello, everyone. First of all, here's a brief outline of my talk. I'm going to begin by motivating why we're interested in studying compact object mergers. And for the purpose of this talk, a compact object is a black hole or a neutron star. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the specific subclass of compact object mergers, which I'm going to focus on, dynamical capture binaries, and how they differ from perhaps the better studied primordial binaries. Then I'm going to present some results from general relativistic hydrodynamical simulations of these events and try to give you a little bit of a feel for the dynamics, both for black hole neutron star binaries and binary neutron star mergers. I'm going to talk a little bit about what kind of electromagnetic transients these events could source, and then switch gears and talk about their gravitational wave signals and some ongoing work to do to determine how detectable these events are. First of all, why are we interested in studying, or sorry, why are we interested in studying compact object mergers? Well, first of all, they're one of the few phenomena which are governed by strong field gravity. You know, despite having the Einstein field equations for almost 100 years now, most of our observational evidence still comes from the weak field regime. Whether it be from solar system tests or indirect evidence of gravitational waves. Compact object mergers are one of the few situations where space-time is highly curved and very dynamic.
The other exception is cosmology.
Huh?
The other exception is cosmology.
Sure.
That's a strong
Yeah, sure. And related to this, compact object mergers are one of the main sources that upcoming gravitational wave detectors are going after, like Advanced LIGO. If you believe the hype, then in a few years, once Advanced LIGO reaches its design sensitivity, then we'll begin to see these events, begin to look into the sky using gravitational astronomy as well as electromagnetic astronomy. Mergers where one of the compact objects is a neutron star, these are particularly interesting, and they're the ones I'm going to focus on in this talk. That's first of all because the neutron star equation of state is set by supernuclear density physics, which we really don't understand. And since this sets the neutron star's radius and its tidal deformability, you could begin to probe these things using compact object mergers and maybe learn something about them. And also, once you introduce matter into the system, you have the possibility of all the electromagnetic transients. And with all the current and upcoming transient surveys that are going online, one of the big buzzwords these days is multi-messenger astronomy, where if you could observe one of these compact object mergers, both using gravitational waves and electromagnetic signal, then you could get a lot more information than if you just had one or the other. So perhaps the better studied sort of
What is PTA?
the factory, yeah, Panamera transient factory,
Panamera. Oh.
yeah. So perhaps the better studied type of binaries are primordial binaries, and these are they're basically the compact objects are born in bound systems, when stars collapse to form neutron stars or black holes, and we basically expect these systems to have essentially zero orbital eccentricity by the time they reach separations where we could begin to detect gravitational waves from them. And that's just because gravitational radiation is so efficient at getting rid of orbital eccentricity. And these are really the main sources that Advanced LIGO was built to go after. Here I put some event rates that Advanced LIGO put out for these events. And so you can see that there's considerable uncertainty, almost two orders of magnitude about how often you'll see these things. But if you believe the, quote, realistic rates, once Advanced LIGO reaches its design sensitivity, things will be quite interesting. However, there's another type of,
What is the spread? That's the.
that's just the citation with this paper.
No, the
Oh,
Fourier
sorry.
like
Yeah,
0.4 to
so
the.
in that paper, they had sort of like a, quote, pessimistic and optimistic rates, and those are the ranges, and then those quote realistic rates, which are in parentheses. But I mean, as you can
You're
see,
aware that this is not the standard way of writing things.
Huh. Okay, sure.
So the standard way is this book needs some kind of error.
Yeah, yeah. So, sorry, I guess that's slightly confusing.
But if error gets very big, then
yeah. The error looks a little smaller than the range.
Yeah, the actual mean is about the error. Right?
Yeah. So sorry. In parentheses is the quote realistic rates. Yeah. And so, yeah, so there's another type of compact object merger called dynamical capture binaries. And these might arise in dense stellar regions, such as the cores of globular clusters or galactic nuclei. And here, the binary would form dynamically when the two compact objects pass by each other close enough to lose energy to gravitational waves, perhaps also tidal effects, and therefore form a bound system. And so a subset of these will actually merge with large orbital eccentricities. And those are mainly the ones I'm interested in talking about today. And the event rates for these are even less well understood. You know, they're not included in this paper by the Van Slyko collaboration. But some people have begun to make some estimates about how often these might happen. So in this O'Leary et al. Paper, they estimated that you could form binary black holes in galactic nuclei. And you'd have, and they estimated Van Slyko rates of something like 1 to 100 per year for these events. Yes, these would be like sort of stellar mass black hole binaries that form around. Like in around, sort of in the neighborhood of the supermassive black hole in the galactic nuclei.
What are you asking? No, I mean, in the future there will be collision, right?
Here I'm talking about sort of stellar mass black hole binaries. But the supermassive black hole sort of collects things around the galactic nuclei and things.
But in this case,
Yeah.
And the question is, what's the frequency of those? Is it known anything about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are more the kind of sources that, like, a LISA type thing would be interested in. Yeah, and so you could also this Li et al. Looked at forming black hole neutron star or binary neutron stars in the cores of globular clusters. And so they estimated global rates of something like 10 to 100 per year per gigaparsec cubed. So first of all, you could compare that to some estimate of the short gamma ray burst rate, which is something like 8 to 30 per year per gigaparsec cubed. So it's definitely not inconceivable that these events could explain a subclass of short gamma ray bursts. And then you could also combine that with some estimate of how far you could see these things to get an advanced LIGO detection rate. So in this COSIS and Levin paper, they estimated that black hole neutron star mergers of this type, you could see out to 200 or maybe 300 megaparsecs. So if you combine that with this global event rate, you get rates of something like 0.3 to 10 per year. And I should also note that this doesn't include close encounters in the strong field regime or the merger signal, which could potentially boost how far you could see these signals. So later in the talk, I'll talk a little bit about some ongoing work to try to include those effects.
So on this point of rates, there was an industry past 10 or 15 years, people trying to build intermediate mass black holes in globular clusters. So they were doing these evolutions and watching binaries form for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, what's the difference between all of those studies and these more recent ones? Have the numbers changed at all, or is this just all pretty much been static, that you'd expect the same number of the same rate of compact object binary?
For the globular cluster stuff, I guess one thing that sort of was new about this paper is they looked at what happens when you undergo core collapse in a globular cluster. So then you get mass segregation, and some of these in-body simulations saw that you could get like hundreds of neutron stars sort of in a very small region during core collapse. And so that's what they looked at here. Basically, most of your numbers you get as the as a globular cluster undergoes core collapse and forms these things.
But can you get intermediate mass black holes after
these? Do you have enough mergers of this kind? Enough mergers of neutron stars or something like that?
Or black holes of neutron
stars. I don't think you'd expect that many. I mean, because like, you know, these are order of a solar mass, the stars, and the black holes are maybe, you know, 10 or something. But yeah, I mean, that's definitely not some, I mean, I think you'd have to have huge rates to get them from this sort of thing. Yeah, so I mean, and a lot of these rates should be taken with a grain of salt, you know, because of course they involve messy astrophysics, you know, what you assume about the number densities of black holes in galactic nuclei. Whether or not what you assume about the retention rates, you know, neutron stars might get kicked out of these globular clusters and that could decrease these rates. But as well, there are effects that we don't really understand that could also give you eccentric mergers, like three-body mechanisms, like the Kozai mechanism or something like that.
Why would neutron stars get kicked out any more than any other star? Why would neutron stars be kicked out any more than
like if they have natal kicks, like when they form, if there's a, you'll have some extra velocity or something, that might reduce the retention rates in globular clusters. Yeah, so given that these, you know, event rates at least make these plausible, what kind of questions might we want to address by studying dynamical capture binaries? So first of all, you can just sort of immediately anticipate that these systems will have an extra variable, which will be the initial impact parameter with which the two compact objects interact, and that the dynamics of the system will be very sensitive to this impact parameter, and you can get a lot of variability with it. So, you know, one question you might want to ask is, could you use this to explain the large variability that people see in short gamma ray bursts? And I think the astrophysicists have a saying, if you've seen one short gamma ray burst, you've seen one short gamma ray burst. You know, some of them have extended X-ray emissions, some of them don't. So that's one question you might want to address. Sort of related question is, you know, do these dynamical capture binaries have any electromagnetic transients that might make them distinguishable from primordial binaries? One thing is that they have sort of more orbital energy compared to quasi-circular binaries. And so you might expect more ejected material from the system. You know, and this ejected material could power transients, you know, when it undergoes the R process and then subsequently undergoes fusion or something like that. Another thing that's special about these systems is that you're introducing an extra time scale. So if the two compact objects you know, initially undergo a close encounter but don't merge, they go out on these long elliptic orbits afterwards. And so you're basically introducing an extra time scale, which is, you know, the period of this long elliptic orbit. So another question you might want to address is, can you use this time scale to explain the precursors that people observe to short gamma ray bursts? Now we have events that precede the actual short gamma ray burst by hundreds or even hundreds of milliseconds or even a second. And another thing is that we know that these systems will have gravitational wave signals that are qualitatively different from quasi-circular. So you want to figure out how far you could see these gravitational wave signals, and also how well current detection or current analysis techniques will do in picking these signals out of the noise, you know, since they are qualitatively different. And so I'm not going to give you a definitive answer to all these questions, but these are the things we've begun to investigate. And the main tool that we're using is fully general relativistic hydrodynamical simulations. So I'm not going to go into the messy details of the code, but the basic idea is that we're solving the Einstein equations coupled to perfect fluid, which is our model for the neutron star. And you know, this is completed by an equation of state. And for the stuff I'm going to show you, we just use a sort of phenomenological piecewise polytrope with an extra thermal component to allow for shock heating. And you know, there's a lot of physics you might want to add to this, you know, magnetic fields, including radiation transport, neutrino cooling, separately modeling the elasticity of the neutron star crust. And, you know, of course, these are ongoing areas of research. But there's a lot you can get out of these simulations just by sort of understanding the bulk dynamics and the gravitational wave signal using these tools. So first of all, I want to just show you a couple results from some work we did studying black hole neutron star dynamical capture binaries. And this is work I did with Branson Stevens and Franz Pretorius. So for these systems, one thing that you can sort of immediately anticipate is, you know, if the two, the black hole and the neutron star initially interact with a small impact parameter, they'll, you know, merge almost head on. If it's a larger impact parameter, they'll undergo a close encounter and then go out on these long elliptic orbits. So there's a threshold here, and you might expect the most interesting behavior sort of around this threshold, especially if you consider an analogy with the unstable circular orbits that exist around black holes. You know, so near black holes, you have these unstable orbits, and if you look at small perturbations around them, you have these what are called zoom whirl orbits, you know, where you go, orbits go around the black hole, you know, a number of times, and then either zoom out on longer elliptic orbits or plunge into the black hole. And in fact, we do find that the dynamics of these systems and things like the amount of matter you get left over in accretion disks and so on are sensitive to where you are in relation to this threshold. So I'm going to show you a couple of animations. This is a 4-to-1 black hole neutron.
You said accretion disk. So what are you starting with
exactly? Just a black hole and a neutron star. And so then they'll, then you know, in some cases they'll merge and the star will get disrupted and right. Some of the matter will. Yeah, so this is a 4-to-1 black hole neutron star system. And I'm showing you rest mass density on a logarithmic scale. And yeah, a couple things to note. Like at the beginning of the simulation, it might appear that the size of the black hole grows slightly, and that's just a coordinate effect. And you might also see some low density material sort of seem to accrete onto the black hole, which is just a numerical artifact of our setup.
So what is HP?
Yeah, that's just one of these piecewise polytrope equations of state. So this is with a relatively small impact parameter. So you can see it's not that exciting. The neutron star is almost swallowed whole by the black hole. And you get very little matter left over post-merger.
What caused the oscillations in the atmosphere?
Hmm?
The neutron stars was falling in, the atmosphere had like a...
Yeah, there's a slight perturbation. Sort of just by the fact that we're combining the neutron star space-time with the black hole space-time. So that's sort of a numerical artifact.
So if you put the neutron star by itself, it wouldn't be oscillating?
If you put the neutron star by itself, then, you know, with enough resolution, the oscillations would get smaller and smaller.
Why do you say it's not exciting?
Hmm?
Why do you say this is not exciting?
Because you.
No, but I mean, you would expect also some gravitational wave burst. Right?
Yeah, so you get but I mean, like, the sort of the gravitational wave signal from a head on is very weak. I mean, so here you do get a decent signal. But also, the reason I was saying that is in terms of electromagnetic transients. Like, you wouldn't expect this to power short gamma ray bursts because there's, you know, essentially very little accretion disk or something like that.
And what's your initial velocity?
So we basically assume that it's marginally unbound. And then if you look at the velocities that maps to Newtonian orbital parameters of like a periastron distance of 5m and eccentricity of essentially 1. So if you consider slightly larger impact parameters, things get more interesting. So this is a slightly larger impact parameter that's just a little bit below the threshold for merger. So here you can see you get a lot of disruption. You know, the star is almost pulled out like spaghetti. And there's a lot of matter left over post-merger. Something like 25 or 30% of the initial neutron star's rest mass is left over. And if you consider the effects of black hole spin,
So do you have magnetic field?
No, we don't. No. I mean, we do allow for like shock heating or something like it, but it's a perfect fluid.
Why didn't you try faster? I mean, in your first plot, you would probably get much more exciting events if you tried if your initial relative velocity was too large.
You mean like the velocity infinity? So I mean, like you expect you expect in a galactic nuclei or something, you know, you get relatively large, like maybe 1,000 kilometers per second. And globular clusters maybe 10 kilometers per second. But compared to the free fall velocity, you know, to these separations,
it's a small velocity.
Yeah. Yeah. So it doesn't matter at all. Yeah. So if you consider, so in this case, this is with a stiffer equation of state. So it's a larger neutron star. You can get even more pronounced behavior.
There's something weird that even before merger happens, there is something like a pair that comes out of the black hole.
Yeah. Yeah. So in this case, you actually get some mass transfer in this like a non-merging close encounter, and then it comes after this short elliptic orbit, it comes back and merges. And again, you have a lot of matter left over post-merger. What you're mentioning is what I was alluding to before. Like it's just a little bit of sort of atmosphere density that gets secreted like onto the black hole.
Does your code allow for radiation emission?
No. Yeah.
But that might influence.
Well, I think that'll. Usually the time scales are longer than, because I mean, like here we're simulating, you know, 30 milliseconds or something like that, right? And you expect that to be hundreds or a second or something.
How much mass was transferred when the first encounter?
Yeah, it was like, I think 30% or something. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, you saw in those examples that I showed you that, you know, for the first video, you had very little material left over post-merger, whereas in the second one, you could have a sizable accretion disk, which might power some sort of, you know, electromagnetic transient. And in a number of these cases, about half the material is actually unbound. So that would be promising for these ejecta power transients. And in some extreme cases where you have, you know, either a stiff equation of state, like the last one I just showed you, or black hole spin that's prograde with respect to the orbital angular momentum, you can get these, you know, significant F-mode excitations and these, and even mass transfer during these non-merger close encounters.
How long does it take to make one of these?
Like a couple weeks on a supercomputer. Yeah.
I have a question. So you have temperature as well, or?
Yeah, effectively. So I mean, we're keeping track of like density and like the specific energy. So it's the same as a temperature essentially. And so you do get heating from shocks exactly.
But isn't it still a polytrope? Isn't that what you said?
So that basically it's a polytrope plus a thermal component. So like the polytrope part determines like the radius of the star and everything. But like there's also the thermal component, you know, that contributes once you get shock heating or whatever.
So what's the form of the equation of state as a function of Bose?
Hmm?
What is the form that you're assuming as a function of both rho naught and epsilon? What is the
form of the equation of state?
Or is the pressure function?
Yeah, so like it's basically just like a polytrope. And you know, we consider some different sort of phenomenal. It's a piecewise polytrope, right? So it's sort of.
It's just a power of a.
So it's a piecewise polytrope, and then we have like a gamma equals 1.5 law for the thermal component. Does that answer your question?
Sorry.
I guess I'm still confused. So you can have an ideal gas with a given adiabatic index, and so then that looks sort of like a polytrope that has a normalization that shifts based upon temperature, right? Or shifts based upon entropy. Or you could imagine that, I think this is what it sounds like you're saying, that you have a barotropic piece, a barotrope piece, so that's your polytrope, and then you're going to add some temperature-dependent contribution to the.
So basically, we're revolving like the density and the specific energy separately. And so you can say, okay, for a given density, you'll get, you know, this much specific energy just from the polytropic piece. And then if you have some extra, that's like the thermal component. And so then that goes into the thermal component of the equation of state, which we just assume like a gamma law with one gamma equals 1.5. And so I want to switch gears a little bit and present some results from binary neutron star mergers. This is work I did recently with my advisor, Franz Pretorius. So one of the particularly interesting things about binary neutron stars, just mergers in general, is you have the possibility of forming a hypermassive neutron star. And that's where, you know, even though the sum of the two neutron star masses is above the maximum mass that a given equation of state could support if the star were cold and static, the star will actually not collapse immediately to a black hole because it's supported by a differential rotation or thermal energy. And so one of the interesting things that we find in these simulations is that this actually becomes a function of impact parameter as well, whether or not you immediately collapse to a black hole or form a hypermassive neutron star. We also find that these events, you know, can give you up to tenths of a solar mass in an accretion disk, and you know, a percent or so in ejected material. And I'll also show you that these have the possibility of having large tidal deformations in the stars when they undergo a close encounter but don't merge, and so you might. This might cause a neutron star crust to crack. Yeah, so this is a equal mass binary neutron star merger. So again, this is one with a relatively small impact parameter. So again, you don't get that much material left over. You sure promptly collapse to form a black hole. Now here's an example with a slightly larger impact parameter. So in this case, it does actually form a hypermassive neutron star. And in fact, this star doesn't collapse on the time scales that we can simulate. So you could estimate, you know, first of all, how long it will take to radiate away the rest of its angular momentum to gravitational waves. And that's something like another 70 milliseconds past the end of the simulation. However, these things also are quite hot from the merger. Like something like 30% of their internal energy is now coming from thermal energy. So they'll probably also have to cool by neutrino cooling or something before they can form a black hole.
Yeah,
there could be a little leftover. So that's sort of like an overestimate of how long it could last.
But the initial stars didn't have any.
No. I mean, the stars themselves are non-spinning. It's all coming from the orbital angular momentum. Yeah, so finally, I want to show you a non-merger case. So here the stars don't merge, but you can see they're quite tidally deformed. These large F-mode oscillations. And you know, if you estimate the induced ellipticity, it's a lot larger than what you need to crack the neutron star crust. So the potential of having one of these events where the neutron star crust is cracked, you know, potentially get flaring or something like that. And then you go back on these long elliptic orbits. So in this case, we can estimate that it'll be about another 70 milliseconds before they come back for another close encounter. You know, and they could potentially do a few of these before finally merging. And you know, you might also expect that with slightly larger impact parameters, you could get even longer times in between these, you know, the sort of crust cracking event and the final merger, which might source a short gamma ray burst or something. So I want to talk a little bit about the possible electromagnetic transients from these events. So this is sort of a laundry list of potential transients. So first of all, as I just mentioned, you know, you might have crust cracking. So some people have estimated that there's something like 10 to the 46 ergs, you know, just stored in the elastic energy of the neutron star crust. You know, so if you, you know, this could potentially source some flaring event or something like that. Like flaring or something. I mean, so it's not that well understood how this, you know, elastic energy would actually translate into something you'd see, but you do have a lot of energy to work with. So people have shown that, you know, you can, these hypermassive neutron stars can build up strong magnetic fields, you know, due to MRI or some other instabilities. And basically, the longer the hypermassive neutron stars last, the larger the magnetic fields you can get. And then potentially that energy will be released when the star actually collapses. So this is another way to get, you know, long-lived hypermassive neutron stars.
What is MRI?
What did you say? Yeah, MRI, like the magnetoresonance instability.
Rotational,
sorry.
What if one of these was a pulsar or something like that? Would you see something? Would you be able to get an interesting signal?
You mean like if it were had some rotational in, if it were spinning?
Well, of course, I suppose the axis would change. I mean, what if it was actually emitting, it was just emitting electromagnetic radiation like this, of the sort that a pulsar does.
Yeah, but
already. Just one of the individual neutrons.
Yeah, but like usually the time scales for that are a lot longer than the merger time scales, right?
Sorry, yes.
I don't know.
So you'd have to be very lucky to get one.
Well, or the process, I mean, the process can actually pump them up, and then you don't have to be that lucky. Now you can see them a lot farther. You actually can get pulsars on steroids.
So
you might think that the signal. So if the crust cracked, for example, would you be able to see that in the?
I mean, if you get flaring or something from that, but.
So one of the way that you tend, one of the models for how you see the crust cracking shapes the magnetosphere around, launches a bunch of energetic particles, and then that produces soft gamma ray flares. Enormously bright. So this is exactly the picture that's seen.
So then of course you have short gamma ray bursts. You know, these events can definitely give you the sort of massive accretion disk that you might need to potentially launch a jet or something like that. So you also might get transients from the ejected material. So in this plot here, I'm showing you the asymptotic velocity of ejected material from binary neutron stars. This is just the rest mass in each of these velocity bins. So for binary neutron star mergers with various parameters. So you can see, you know, first of all, that this ejected material is sort of mildly relativistic with speeds about 0.2 times the speed of light. And you can also get up to maybe 1% or so, or even more than of a solar mass. And so, one mechanism that people looked at is, what's called the kilonovia, where this ejected material, as it decompresses, would undergo the R process, build up these heavy elements, and then as it subsequently undergoes nuclear decay, you could get a transient. And so some people have sort of estimated the time scales and the luminosities for these. So if you, for example, just plug in this red curve to those estimates, you get a transient that peaks on order of a day. It gives you something like 4 times 10 to the 42 ergs per second, and that would be the optical near UV. And then as this ejected material, collides with the interstellar medium, other authors have hypothesized that you might get a radio wave signal. So again, just plug into that red curve, you get a radio signal of about 0.4 millijanskis. And that would peak on time scales of weeks.
Also based on the simulation that you have, doesn't have magnetic fields, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we know that if you add magnetic fields, then you tend to make jets which do produce relativistic material. So I wonder whether this is just this is just a small fraction of this material.
This is the unbound material. So the
yeah. I mean, that's the thing. So if you add magnetic fields, then you well, at least for a spinning black hole, you expect to make jets.
Right.
Which are relativistic. I wonder whether that's going to be a bigger fraction than the one that you get from non-magnetic simulation. But the magnetic field is crucial to launch it.
Mm-hmm.
See what I'm saying?
Well, but yep. That this ejecta is for explaining something else. Like a third of the Chorgan or Burroughs show this extended emission for even hundreds of seconds. And then the question is, how can you maintain something going on for such a long time? And so then that model was brought in that context. You send material out, and then as it comes back in that time scale, then you could keep powering.
Well, this is the shocking ISM from the ejector. This is the supernova run.
That's the second. Sorry, I was thinking about the R one, the one that I met her at Parchisky.
So I think the one that Mayesh was referring to is something like the last one, but from termination shock in jets.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't. Yeah, I don't know the answer, but I mean, I guess you do expect the sort of that sort of perpendicular, that's like in the jet direction, right? Where you expect it to be sort of somewhat baryon free, right? But I mean, yeah, I don't know the answer to that question, if that would be bright or not.
I don't know. I mean, I guess my only point is that be that magnetic. Whatever you have is what you have. You made it at the beginning.
Right.
But then, if you do have magnetic fields, you can continuously launch stuff to relativistic space out of this.
Well, I think some people have brought into Bianca company have a mechanism based on to confine the injector.
Well, I mean, I guess you don't have neutrinos here either, so that's
it. So Shapiro and company did some very limited simulations of magnetized neutron star and neutron star mergers.
Mm-hmm.
And do you recall
hey,
that this?
I accept that.
and present. but in any of those, did anybody see jet production? You want to answer that?
I mean, you can talk later on.
So the AI group made a big kind of PR thing. After the merger takes place, you actually have these winding fields, and then that would call it a jet. But there is, you're using an approximation that is, you probably don't necessarily put a lot of faith in, because now you're still using ideal LHC, and the density is very, very low. But the configuration of the fields are nice to this process, and you expected that, because it's a very strong winding would give this cone anyway. So that's the extent to people have explored this, and the Japanese group, Shapiro, the AI, and NASA, I think those are the four groups that have done, they all agree.
Computationally, it's very challenging, though, because as the tidal disruption occurs, you mainly get toroidal and very little colloidal field, which you need for resolving the MRI instability. So that makes it, just from a computational point of view, quite challenging.
Yeah, so I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the gravitational wave signals you get from these events. So here's sort of like a characteristic signal. During these, during each non-merger close encounter, you sort of get a burst of gravitational waves. And though most of the simulations I showed you, there's only one or two close encounters before merger, they could potentially have a whole series of these leading up to the merger. And you get this merger ringbound signal at the end.
Use quadruple formula for these, or something
else? You can just directly extract the gravitational waves from the simulations, and then Slayer 2 will talk about ways to sort of model that. Yeah. And so, if you compare this to a quasi-circular signal, like on the right, you can see these are qualitatively different. You can also imagine that, if all your effort in data analysis is going after looking like signals like this, you can very easily miss signals like those on the left.
Is there any significance in the difference between cross and flat polarization here?
It depends on your orientation, yeah.
Do you have anything you definitely could say, or does it depend on impact parameter details? You seem to predict quite different. Is it something generic?
I'm not sure if you can see it. It's about the same amplitude.
But there's a phase difference.
They're not different. I don't think they're different.
Well, but there's a phase delay and stuff like this.
In principle, you could determine the orientation of a binary or something.
Yeah, if you could measure the difference.
Yeah, sure.
But there is nothing generic.
Yeah.
How worried should gravitational wave people be about this? What fraction of potential merger or potential binaries will be in this left-hand case compared to, say, the right-hand case?
I gave you the event rates before. So, if you take sort of I guess the sort of realistic advanced LIGO rates give, 40 or something per year. And the numbers I quoted were something like a few per year.
Don't you need to be for these zoom world type, I assume that's what we're looking at over here, the zoom world type orbit. Don't you need to be shooting the eye of the needle? You need to have a very specific set of initial conditions to get to that?
You need somewhat special conditions to get zoom whirling, but definitely not to get these series of bursts, which is the main signal.
Eccentric binary will do this and they'll miss that.
Yeah. They'll all have some number of bursts leading up to merger.
The issue with the fine tuning in the zoom world case is more in the S particle of the GDC case. If you're comparable mass binaries, it's a little better.
Yeah, so getting to the point you were talking about. So these gravitational wave signals do show strong field effects that we see in the numerics. So in this plot on the left here, what I'm showing you is just the energy and gravitational waves for one of these bursts. And I'm showing you as a function of the periastron distance, RP. So you can see that, the red dots are the simulation results. You can see that as you approach the threshold for the two objects to merge, you get a huge enhancement in the amount of energy and gravitational waves. And that's compared to this dotted blue line, which is sort of just the answer you get if you took the Newtonian trajectories and plugged them into the quadrupole formula. And so this black line is just sort of a fitting formula that's meant to suggest this analogy with these zoom whirl orbits that exist if you look at geodesics around a black hole spacetime. And so you do see evidence of this whirling behavior in the merger gravitational wave signals as well. So on the right, I'm showing you the merger signals from several different black hole neutron star mergers. And you can see that sort of, you know, after the peak, they all have this characteristic ring down signal. But before the peak, they, you know, show varying amounts of this whirliness behavior, where the, you know, neutron star can sort of go around the black hole a couple times before plunging. And then this last one right here is from the last black hole neutron star simulation I showed you, where you get a very wimpy gravitational wave signal for merger because part of the star has already been accreted during this non-merging close encounter.
In the four picture on the right, is that something funny happening on the first bump? I mean, is the bump, is the fence, or is it that my eyes are weird?
It looks like it's great, like a wave breaking.
Yeah, I don't know if there's anything that special going on, or just an artifact. So that case is like the retrograde spin. So you can actually get sort of more whirling behavior because the sort of the effective visco is farther away from the black hole. Yeah. So you know, if you want to address issues of detectability for these events, you need to, you know, have templates that for the full waveforms. So you want to include a large number of these close encounters, you know, which is not feasible to do with the full numerics because of the long time scales involved. But you might also want to include these strong field effects in the merger signal, you know, because they might potentially boost the signal. So something I've been working on with Sean McWilliams, Jan 11, and Franz Vittorius has been to try to sort of come up with a model for these waveforms. And that'll allow us to, you know, sort of map out a larger parameter space. And also, so people have sort of, as I mentioned before, looked at this using post-Newtonian, but we want to also include these strong field effects for post-Newtonian breaks down. So I wasn't planning to go into the details of this model, but basically we're sort of mapping the two-body problem to an sort of an effective one-body problem by looking at geodesics on a black hole space-time, and then sort of using quadrupole radiation formula to feed back into that and, you know, lose energy and angular momentum to quadrupole radiation, and also including a model for the merger signal.
You mean instead of using Newtonian and then quadrupole, you use the Einsteinian and then quadrupole?
Yeah, yeah, basically like a geodesic.
Just a fixed background black hole, but a test particle.
Yeah, so sort of, yeah, something almost like that. And but then you sort of, we also, you know, calculate the energy and angular momentum you'd lose during each close encounter. And so we let those sort of, you know, what are constants for geodesics, like, you change with time. But
some of these you showed the excitation of large modes, which, I mean, what fraction of the orbital energy can be soaked up in those oscillations?
Yeah, yeah, those F-mode oscillations. So one thing to keep in mind is that, like, you know, it appears there's a lot of angular momentum there, but it's actually a pattern speed. It's not rigidly rotating. Mm-hmm. So it's not as much angular momentum as it looks like. Though I don't have like the exact numbers for you. But like, you know, if we look at like the gravitational wave signal or something, you can sort of, you know, see these small sort of almost sine waves from those oscillations, but they're much slower than the burst part of the gravitational waves.
Does it affect the orbit that you dumped energy now into the star?
Yeah.
The energy came out of the orbit.
Yeah, and one interesting thing is that, you know, even if it's a small amount of orbital energy, you know, that could have a huge effect on the time scale for the next close encounter. Mm-hmm. So I mean, we do see you know, sort of equations of state effects that can, you know, change the sort of time scale for the next close encounter a lot. So that might be one way to sort of get a handle on these, is because you don't need to resolve sort of exactly the burst, you know, frequency itself, but just the timing in between bursts. That could give you a lot of information. Yeah, so this model is, you know, not good enough to do match filtering or anything like that, but you can, you know, use it to begin to get an idea of how far you might be able to see these signals, and as well as, you know, what kind of detection strategies do you need to go after these events? So just as one sort of one illustration, it's going to talk about sort of the idea of, you know, when you see an electromagnetic transient and you're simultaneously looking for gravitational waves, when you can sort of use a null detection to rule out a compact object merger as being the source of that event. So, you know, for just as an illustration, during the LIGO S5 run, you know, they didn't claim any detections, but they were collecting data while a number of gamma ray bursts went off nearby. So, for example, they looked at this GRB 051103 event, and it was near M81 and M82. And so, you know, because they were looking for gravitational waves and didn't see any, you know, they sort of ruled out a quasi-circular binary neutron star merger or black hole neutron star merger as giving rise to this event. And so, you know, people didn't necessarily think this was a short gamma ray burst. It seems more likely it might be a soft gamma ray repeater or something like that. However, you know, you can ask the question, what if this were a dynamical capture binary? You know, would LIGO have seen the gravitational wave signal? So basically, we're going to use our model and then the initial LIGO noise curve and say, you know, if you take fix one of the compact objects to be 1.4 solar masses and then consider different mass ratios and different impact parameters, you know, how far could LIGO have seen this with an SNR of 8? So this GRB event occurred at 3.6 megaparsecs. So this top figure is what you get if you assume ideal templates, so, you know, perfect match filtering. And so you can see that, and so the 3.6 megaparsec contours, you know, right between the sort of light blue. Yes, right here. So you can see that for a large part of parameter space, you know, basically all the larger impact parameters and anything that's not very nearly equal mass ratios, LIGO could have seen this. However, you know, LIGO doesn't have, you know, templates for these events. So they do have quasi-circular templates or these burst searches. So in this middle figure, I'm showing you what you get if you use one of these like Sine-Gaussian templates for these events. And you can see that, you know, that significantly degrades how far you can see these signals. You know, basically for all this parameter space, LIGO would have missed this event. Now, you know, perhaps it's not reasonable to expect that in the near future we'll be able to come up with templates for these events. However, one way that you could potentially do better is using incoherent power stacking. You know, so basically, adding up the power from a number of these bursts. You know, you would lose some of the information because you're throwing away the phase. We could still do better than with one of these unmodeled burst searches. And so this last figure is sort of an estimate of how well you might be able to do using an approach like that. And so you can see that, you know, of course, it's not as good as, you know, match filtering, but you still see a lot more parameter space than with one of these unmodeled burst searches.
I'm sorry, I think I might have missed it, but Q is mass ratio?
Yeah, sorry, Q is mass ratio.
Stacking multiple systems that have potentially different parameters, or
no? So that would be stacking the power from multiple bursts from the same.
And so,
yeah. So I mean, this is not like we don't have a strategy yet. So this is something we're working on now. But
if you were optimally able to be stacking that
same, essentially, yeah. I mean, basically, this is just using the fact that, you know, instead of going like the square root of n for the number of bursts, you go like the square root of, you go like into the 1/4.
Presumably, if you have a model accurate enough to tell you when to do the stacking, have a model accurate enough to get a lot closer to the ideal case.
I mean, maybe.
It's probably just as hard to track.
But I mean, you could imagine sort of searching over parameters and just, I mean, you just need to sort of you know, you might find your loudest burst, right? And then sort of use that to anchor your search. And then, you know, say this burst isn't loud enough to be detectable on its own, but I sort of use that and then say, okay, if there were bursts here, like for different parameters, you know, where would the previous bursts be? And, you know, you probably wouldn't be able to do this ideally, but you could hope to get, you know, a lot closer to this.
Sorry, I'm still a little confused. So the idea is that you have this binary which is losing mass periodically, and that's producing a sequence of bursts, or?
Yeah, it's losing orbital energy and angular momentum. Basically, okay. Most of it is lost during this close encounter.
So those bursts in that waveform you showed on the left side a while ago that we talked about, that wasn't zoom world. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the zoom row was more like the merger ones I showed on the right. I mean, you basically get almost sort of sine wave type things, right? Because it's basically going around.
Yeah. No, I had a confusion on that. Thank you.
So is there any hope? You said that they actually were taking data during LIGO was taking data.
Yeah, and that's saved.
Could you go back and try and fit it?
Yeah.
That's what it is.
You did that.
Oh, no.
No.
They did with their analysis, not with this kind of.
Yeah,
that's
so I mean so yeah, if you come up with better techniques, they can go back and look for those signals.
Wait, so I mean, in this case, you have a definite signal. I mean, you have the electromagnetic signal.
Yeah, yeah. The people don't necessarily think that was.
And try and find something. I don't know how well you
can. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's definitely something they could do.
Why is it that people don't think the word TRB is for this soft gamma ray repeater?
Oh. Why did they think it was that and not a short gamma ray burst?
Right.
Yeah, I forget the details of the event, but I mean.
No, afterglow, different type of afterglow, not just breaking or something.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't remember that offhand. Yeah, so that's basically the end of my talk. So I hope I showed you how these dynamical capture binaries can, you know, show large variability with impact parameter and how you can use them to probe strong field gravity. And you have the possibility of, you know, lots of electromagnetic transients from these events, you know, from the large accretion disks, the ejected material, potentially neutron star crust cracking. And, you know, in order to be able to, you know, confirm or rule out the, you know, existence of these gravitational wave signals from these events, you know, you need to search for them using analysis techniques that are geared toward these specific types of events. Thanks.
So, I guess the first part of where we talk about dynamical capture, I didn't quite understand what you mean by dynamical capture. So, is it that you have the free body interactions, or is it that the one body becomes so close to the other body that it's captured?
Yeah. The latter.
It's the latter.
Yeah.
So that has a very small cross section happening, right?
Well, I mean, you do sort of, you get this gravitational focusing effect, right? Where.
You get some gravitational focusing.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the fact that basically the cross section is going to be linearly proportional to the periastron distance, right? But I mean, that's what these estimates were based on. Yeah, gravitational focusing or tidal capture.
So the angular momentum essentially should be low enough so that you get through the barrier, and that's the estimate that has been done. Is that because I mean, in Neutron gravity, you have an infinite angular momentum barrier, you can never get through it, no matter how low angular momentum.
Yeah, but I mean, here you're losing energy and angular momentum to gravitational waves. That's how you form a balanced system.
You're using gravitational waves.
Losing. You're losing energy and angular momentum to gravitational waves.
But, again, my point, you don't have to. I mean, even if you don't lose energy to gravitational waves, you can be captured by. I mean, I guess you don't orbit. You can just go through and merge. Mm-hmm. But I guess the gravitational wave increases the effect, but not by much. But basically, you have to get to within a few Schwarzschild radius.
No.
Right.
No, I mean, like, I mean, so it depends on what you assume the velocity at infinity is, right? So, I mean, for globular clusters, that's pretty low. It's like 10 kilometers per second or something,
uh-huh.
right? So there, I mean, if you just use Peters and Matthews or something, you need a periastron distance of like 500 m or something like that.
500 m.
Yeah. And so for galactic nuclei, you have a higher velocity infinity, like 1,000 kilometers per second, and there it's like 40 m or something. But it's definitely not a Schwarzschild radius.
So when you say, when you're giving those numbers, does that mean that if you had a velocity of 10 kilometers per second, you'd be bound at that distance? Or are we talking about gravitational brimstone? Because that's normally when you say gravitational processes capture, and that's what I have in mind.
Yeah, so if you have that velocity and infinity, that's basically how much, you know, how different it is, like how hyperbolic it is, right? And so basically, if you undergo a close encounter with that periastron distance, then you lose enough energy where now you're
okay, so
a bound system.
We are talking about gravitational motion.
Yeah.
But that's not Peters and Matthews, right? Those were just circular orbits. Closed orbits.
I mean, yeah, they just did Newtonian orbits, like in quadrupole. I mean, so you could do like the E equals one case with Peters and Matthews still.
They don't have to be circular, right?
Yeah.
But I thought they were all bound.
Yeah, I think they do. But I mean, you can, yes, I guess there's like the Turner paper too.
There's a whole issue where the gravitational wave emission comes in the Peters and Matthews one. That's a statement, right?
So the 500 m, let's say that's where capture happens. But you have to get from 500 m to 2 m or something like that. And doesn't the orbits become circular by the time that happens?
Yeah, so a subset of these will circularize by merger. And so like for the galactic nuclei, so basically, so for like the galactic nuclei case, you know, you expect, I don't know, 30 or 40% of these to merge with, eccentricity of, 0.1 or 0.2 or something. For the globular cluster case, it's going to be a few percent or something if you consider this capture by gravitational waves all the way up to 500 m or something.
So I guess the spinning of neutron stars probably is not very relevant because. The scale here was a little bit of 10 milliseconds, and this scale is only very fast spinning. That would be important. But spin of the black hole is probably important.
Yeah, and
so
it
can
is.
You comment on it?
Yeah, so I mean, sort of the, I mean, you can, just by analogy with these geodesics in the black hole space time, you know, that sort of the effect of ISCO will, move out for retrograde spin, and it'll move in for prograde spin with respect to the orbital angular momentum, right? So basically, you find that for retrograde spin, you can sort of get more whirling behavior because it's the star sort of going around at a, it's not being disrupted because it's sort of whirling at a larger radius. But for prograde spin, you can get more disruption events because of this, the ISCO has moved in closer. And so like you get sort of, with prograde spin, you get something similar to the case where I showed you with the stiff equation of state, we can get.
But when it comes to the actual rotational wave form, signal form, would you expect similar forms or would you expect some important difference in case of spinning wave form?
You're still going to have these bursts leading up to merger. So some of those ones I showed you were like.
So
like this case, for example, is with retrograde spin, right? Mm-hmm. And you can see, like here, it's sort of whirling at a larger radius, and so it doesn't have to like plunge in immediately. It's not getting disrupted. But for the prograde spin, you expect more tidal disruption, and so sort of more accretion disk and stuff, but less energy and gravitational waves or something like that. If the star is getting disrupted.
How do you compare your results with previous work even from the Newtonian side, like Fabric's own or black hole neutron star, like
François? Have we compared our
results
with the quasi circular stuff, like the Caltech?
There are some simulations done in something from Faber and Brasio, where they study the neutron star merges with SPH hydro simulation. radius diagram display.
And they're also solving the field equations, or
no? I was just thinking.
Okay. Yeah. I mean.
So my question is, and they had a computation of gravitational waves using quad deformers, so how you compare
with Newtonian? Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, one thing that you get is like sort of similar to what people saw, you know, with quasi-circular when they started doing full GR versus Newtonian. Like, you know, with the Newtonian, you can get sort of a lot, you know, because you don't have an ISCO, you know, you can get these stars being, get very close to the black hole, get disrupted, lots of material flies out. So we found, you know, less ejected material, less accretion, like matter and accretion material, sorry, matter in the accretion disk compared to Newtonian. So you can still get sort of those sizable amounts for some orbital primers, but they sort of find that generically for the Newtonian ones.
So you pointed out maybe the most interesting thing would be cross correlations between the electromagnetic signal and the gravitational wave signal.
Mm-hmm.
But how well can you forecast what electromagnetic signal you would get from some of these? Or can you tell it all, or do you just need to go and redo the simulation with electromagnetic?
It's hard to get, you know, exactly get out the signal you'd see. So we're just sort of doing it at the level of, you know, do you have the large accretion disks that you need for a short gamma burst, or, you know, how much ejected material you have to sort of work with, you know, for one of these, you know, nuclear decays or something like that. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, exactly getting what those signals will be from a particular event, yeah, there's a lot more physics you need to put in.
So, I mean, I was thinking of these ones that LIGO saw or didn't see. You have a lot of, in principle, you have a lot of information there from the electromagnetic signal.
Mm-hmm.
Could you use it somehow to narrow down in your parameter space what kind of thing you would like to simulate?
If
there's a gravitational template that they could look for? Or is it just...
Yeah,
the
I mean...
The connection is just too loose.
It's too far.
Yeah, it's not adding Maxwell's equation.
So this the engine is here. Well, the engine is here. Something happened, and then you release, and then it begins to interact. And then what you see is what was
oh,
produced way up here. And so then.
Oh, so it's a much later kind of. Thing.
Well, a much longer scale from the inner engine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And not just that, there are a lot of uncertain steps. So I mean, you produce some sort of electromagnetic outflow. You produce some outflow. Then you have to understand particle acceleration. Any number of interesting emission mechanisms, all of which are loosely understood. And they all add fudge factors.
So to go from that waveform to anything that you would see electromagnetically is more or less hopeless at present, is that?
But I don't think that's necessary. So the point is to have a bright spot on the sky you can go to and say, that's the galaxy that this thing happened, and then that's enough.
Right, so ideally you use the information from both. You say, okay, fine. You see them here in the same place, then you believe it's kind of from the same system.
Okay,
gravity waves reduces a lot of the uncertainties as far as the engine is concerned, and then the timing, then then you begin to compare models to see which one.
But now you're assuming you saw the gravitational wave.
That's
but without the template, it's
without
very
the template,
difficult to do that.
Well, even then, I mean, even as Chad, they do burst searches, right? Or they do targeted searches, so you see an electromagnetic event that puts a prior on the, insofar as you knew roughly what the right class of templates were, then you can go look at that period of time carefully.
Right, but yeah. If I understood, you don't even have the right class of templates. You just have a few randomly generated ones, so,
mm-hmm.
which we saw.
Okay, so William is still here through the day. He lives tomorrow morning. He's also has a whole bunch of other things to show about high-speed collision of stars. That's actually pretty cool. He's forming black holes in the LHC or something. But if you want to ask him, you can ask him offline. So let's thank William again.